Hey everybody, welcome back to Bond by Numbers. Today's episode is The Golden Age of Bond, or what if there was a golden age of James Bond? And of course, by golden age, we're not talking about the early Connery films, we're talking about the golden age of cinema, the 30s, the 40s, and creeping into the 1950s.
Yeah, technically you could go to like the 20s to...
The studio era.
The studio era, exactly.
Cool. Well, we did try this episode a couple times before, didn't we, Jeff? And it didn't quite work out.
Yeah. This one has got some gremlins in it, and we're hopefully we chase them away. Or yeah, that's what we're hoping.
We're basically each assigned a decade, and we're going to take a James Bond film that you're all familiar with, and we're going to see how that film could have been made in that decade. How would the script change? What studio would produce it? Who would direct it? Who would star in it? It's going to be a lot of fun.
It is. And
again,
we started this one out, didn't we, guys? And again, yeah, the third time fun. we started this out by rolling the roulette, and we were going to, at first, assign each of us two random films from the series. But instead, when our roles were all bringing up Brosnan, they were all coming up Brosnan, what we decided to do was just to focus on one film from Pierce Brosnan's era. So if you're hoping for us to do an early take or a fun adaptation of a Connery or a Moore, that's not going to happen here. Instead, we're bringing you Brosnan theme. And I think that's only fair because I think Brosnan's a Bond maybe doesn't get as much love as he deserves. So this is us redoing three Brosnan films. And I don't know, would you agree with that, guys? That Brosnan doesn't exactly get elbowed out the way, but he still is kind of the other one. You know, he's one of the other ones.
That's what I was going to say. That's what I was going to say is like, well, if you speak to like people, my parents' generation, they love Brosnan. He's getting his due.
He's my second favorite James Bond. You know, I remember when we did our Bond.
Man, I love, don't get me wrong, especially because he kind of looks like my dad, and I agree with that. And my dad, my dad was always sort of like
that. He was secretly chuffed.
I mean, it's true, and he really did. Like, if you look at Brosnan, like in the early '80s, and you see a photo of my dad, and even like Goldeneye era, like he looks like my dad. For sure. And my dad was like very kind of like, oh, that's very nice of you. But he took the compliment for sure. Yeah. Why not?
I mean, Brosnan was my Bond growing up because that was the decade in which I was in, you know, in my adolescence and post-adolescence when you appreciate James Bond for what he is more than just being like this cool action hero when you're a kid. So Brosnan was the Bond of my generation. Absolutely. And Craig, to an extent, I suppose, too, in my post, you know, university life and adult life, it was Craig, obviously. But in my late childhood, it was definitely Brosnan. Yep. But I was thinking about your dad, though. Wouldn't his Bond have been like Moore or Connery or something like that? Or
well, his Bond was. I'm just saying people like I'm saying my dad's age when Brosnan started to get popular. Right. I'm saying, but yeah, when my dad was a kid. Oh, yeah, it was definitely Connery when he was a kid and, you know, like Roger Moore and stuff, because my dad watched all of them in the theaters.
Yes.
Like he was a very big Bond fan. Right. But I just more meant like when people started to really know who Brosnan was when he was sort of up and coming in his early 30s, because he's exactly the same age as my dad. So ironically, that's the other thing, too. Like, they're almost identical.
That's true.
Have they ever been in the same room together?
Conspiracy.
If they were, and I was not told, boy, oh, boy, my dad's off the Christmas card.
I think the Irish accent might give a little bit away.
That's right.
But, yeah. But just to state, and your dad also didn't go into, like, some national park and cause a ruckus, right? So I don't think that happened either. Sorry, Pierce. But the Brosnan Bond is definitely, you could qualify him as the late... As the 90s Bond, you know, like post-Cold War, action hero-oriented, really much coming off from like the Schwarzeneggers and Stallones of the 80s, going into that techno thriller. That was kind of, it wasn't camp at the time. It's become more campy and comic booky in retrospective. No. But at the time, these were really big action. These were really big action films coming after GoldenEye in particular. And even critics were saying how like, Bond seems to be amped up as an action hero more than a suave spy. I remember Roger Ebert talking about that too. And then he found that like Rules on Enough, for example, was a return to form because it reminded him more of the Moore era than like the previous one, Tomorrow Never Dies, did. He found that was like a very cool like kung fu movie with James Bond kind of being a bit of an overt Schwarzeneggerian, you know, action hero with like two machine guns in his hand and shooting at guys. So, you know, but I'm pointing out is that the Brosnan Bond is definitely, even though he goes into the early 2000s, he's definitely the 90s Bond. No, there's no argument about it. And he represents what the 90s is. So I think it'll be really interesting to take a time period, the post-Cold War, was a period in which, you know, Brosnan thrived in terms of the stories that were told, and placing that into a different context. I mean, technically, we're going pre-Cold War here almost, if you think about it, or just at the start of the Cold War is our cutoff point, because we have the we have basically the 50s, the 40s, and the 30s assigned to each of us with one Bond movie for the decade for us to translate into that time. So this should be interesting.
It will be. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yep.
It will be. And when we rolled the dice out and we got each of our respective films assigned, we then kind of chose the decades, didn't we? I didn't really have a preference either way. So I think the way we situated this was that GoldenEye, which was assigned to Jeff, Jeff decided to do from a 1940s
Jeff
point
did
of view,
40s.
Right, Jeff?
That's correct. Yeah. Yes, correct.
I've got Tomorrow Never Dies, which I've set in the 1950s, and Josh has got?
The 1930s, the early sound period of the studio era, right? So, yeah. Die Another Day. Wish me luck.
die
I mean,
die
it's
another
too late
day
now because I already wrote it up, so we'll see how it goes.
It'll be good. So shall we do this in chronological order? Shall we just...
Yeah,
Okay. Well, thanks everybody for joining us here on this, our final What If of Bond by Numbers. We're on episode 99 right now, the Wayne Gretzky of Bond by Numbers podcast episodes. And this is a mixed metaphor. I don't know what I'm on about.
I was going to say Agent 99.
Agent 99. That's much better.
Smart. Barbara Felden.
Better. Yeah. anyway, after this, it's going to be our finale, our great finale. And we'll say more about that at the end of the show. But for now, sit back, relax, and take a seat in the time machine. And 00 Chapman, 00 Taylor, and myself are going to take you back to the what-if history of these James Bond movies that never were but might have been, starting with the 1930s and Josh's take on Die Another Day.
I got the 1930s. This is an era of Hollywood that I've been kind of researching in the past couple of months. It kind of ties into the Lighting the Pipes noir show that I do with our regular Lighting the Pipes series, just because a lot of film noir, its origin came from the 1930s, film, the gangster films and other genres at the time. So, you know, it was, and also looking back at the filmmakers, the actors and whatnot, going through, you know, jumping into the 30s is a worthwhile endeavor in terms of, you know, learning more about the history of Hollywood, because it's such a formative period. It's the era in which we had the transition from silent film to sound at the beginning. It's the era of the pre-code, where a lot of films that were made at the time were very, very close to the morals being portrayed in modern times, in our own time, until, of course, censorship came in and pretty much shut that down for quite a long, long time. So you, in that period, you get to see almost like stories about real people and not, you know, something censored and made to be kind of conservative, very conservative minded and pure, almost puritanical in terms of navigating the type of storytelling, if you catch my drift. So the 30s eventually bleeds into the 40s. But so it's a very formative and artistic, a time of artistic exploration, a time of censorship, and a way of working around the system, you know, to foster creativity. So it was a very interesting time and a very colorful time for the studio era. Now, the film that I was assigned, of course, is Die Another Day. And this is a movie that involves a geopolitical setup that just didn't exist at that time. Like, Korea was not the nation that it was in the 1930s. You know, it was a different story altogether. There wasn't a North and South Korea. There wasn't satellites with, you know, that could destroy, you know, a mined border. The political situation at time simply did not exist, you know, and some of this technology and the were essentially science fiction. And if you think about Die Another Day, there's a lot of science fiction in that movie anyways. But I did my best giving a go at it. So what I'm presenting here is a little bit of fun. It's basically the story of how Die Another Day was actually made, or how it could have been made at the time. But I will state that even if I didn't do this, the directors and actors and crew that I would choose to make this film are the ones that I would choose outside of, you know, this little story that I wrote up here for you guys, okay? All right. So it began just prior to Daryl Zanuck's departure from Warner Brothers after being the pivotal production head that had kept Warners alive during the Depression. And that, of course, the social realist films, like the gangster crime films such as Public Enemy with Jimmy Cagney and I Was a Fugitive in a Chain Gang. During this time, Hal Wallace was Zanuck's right-hand man, taking notes from production to production, espousing creativity under the dominion of studio head Jack Warner and CFO Harry Warner. Wallace was the only man left standing in the spring of 1933, when Zanuck, tired of the budget constraints and salary cutting of the cast and crew, left Warner Brothers to form 20th Century Fox Studios with Joseph Schenck. Zanuck had been a hard-working head of production at Warner's, but for all his blood, sweat, and tears in keeping Warner Brothers alive, he was no longer found indispensable, once all that sound technology Warner made a go of the musical again. They made famous in the pre-code era by the wild, exhilarating production design and choreography of directors like Busby Berkeley, for example. Those musicals became the big draw, and Harry Warner chose to spend budget and salaries on them. Zanuck fought but lost and made his exit from the Burbank lot. Jack Warner made Hal Wallace the new head of production, overseeing a writer's bullpen and expected success going forward. No pressure, right? Actually, this put Wallace under an exorbitant amount of pressure. In a weak moment, Wallace tried mescaline, and indeed tripped the light fantastic from his experience. The dosage had occurred in some dingy basement off Wilchard Boulevard, where Wallace and other phenoms of Tinseltown had created their own little opium den of sorts. Witnesses testified to Wallace making utterances of time travel and, quote-unquote, Zanuck is right to fear the Japanese. After a rough night and a few days of detox, Wallace addressed the WB writer's bullpen with a new story idea. And this was how Die Another Day happened, and subsequently, why
it's an acid trip, essentially. A mescaline trip, rather.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
On par with Huxley there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, the doors of perception there.
Indeed. It is clear through the intake of mescaline, Wallace had in some fashion crossed the space-time continuum and traveled to a future Earth, or perhaps an alternate Earth. Regardless, he came up with the premise of Die Another Day, which shockingly echoes the plot structure of a film from the James Bond franchise released in 2002. Not to mention the fact that the recently recovered nitrate reel of Hal Wallace's Die Another Day features a protagonist named James Bond, 20 years prior to the publication of Ian Fleming's Casino Royale, in which the hero spy debuted. Thanks to his mentor Zanuck, Wallace's fear of the growing threat of Imperial Japan was espoused in the screenplay. Imperial Japan thus replaces the more modern 21st century threat of North Korea, a nation-state and geopolitical situation that Wallace did not completely understand during his extratemporal experience. Japan had recently invaded Manchuria. Despite the League of Nations' stern warning, it wished to be an imperial power like that of the US, England, France, etc., and was growing increasingly more militaristic in terms of its government, which was at the time a constitutional monarchy. but bouts with Russia in the early 20th century and recent claims in Asia butted Japan against the other superpowers in the worldly power struggle. In this notion, Wallace aimed to create a message film to highlight the possible dangers of a totalitarian Japan. The story, as Wallace intended, goes kind of like this. So James Bond is an officer in British intelligence assigned to Hong Kong. There is a renegade Tojo-esque colonel in the Japanese army, a Hideyoshi Tokugawa, who is also a half-breed. Japanese on his mother's side and British on his father's, a la Dr. No, kind of. Tokugawa is making deals with the Hong Kong underworld, particularly that of the criminal organization, the Tong. Bond follows Tokugawa to Okinawa, where Tokugawa and other radical imperialists are having a big meeting, and there is a showdown between British and Japanese forces that ends with Tokugawa killed by the former and Bond a prisoner of the latter. Bond is left to rot and to be tortured in a Japanese prison camp until a prisoner exchange occurs a year later and both men are released. Due to the secret treaty signed between British and the Japanese secret services, Bond cannot continue his operation, even though there be many loyalists out there, including Zhao, Tokugawa's right-hand man who was a Chinese traitor. Zhao is stirring things up in the HK underworld, though, and even though he is reassigned, Bond escapes custody when he learns Zhao is alive and well. Zhao seems to be the henchman of the British House of Peers, one Sir Gustav Graves, who has made his name in diamonds in South Africa and is now turning to shipbuilding in Hong Kong to increase his wealth. Bond suspects via Jinx, a prostitute who is actually an American agent in disguise, who has revealed to Bond of Graves' extracurricular practices. Bond tries to out Graves at every opportunity, trying to find his connection to the gangster Zhao. A romantic triangle occurs between Jinx and Miranda Frost, the British agent assigned to Graves, but she is actually a double agent. When a lead leads Bond to an island in the Solomons, where Graves has set up a private resort, it turns out he has been using his wealth and the anti-British Chinese government, or anti-British Chinese resistance, to create a fleet to attack Hong Kong, irrevocably forcing the Japanese to war against the West. Why does Graves want to help Japan? Well, before being captured in Graves' headquarters, he learns that Graves has previously undergone a miraculous cosmetic surgery, a procedure that transformed him from his original visage, that of Hideyoshi Tokugawa. Bond is left for dead, but is captured by Tong pirates, one that are not loyal to Zhao, but despite being criminals, are Chinese patriots in their own way. They make a deal with the British, agreeing to be privateers to take out Graves' invasion fleet. There is a final showdown on the deck of Tokugawa's flagship, between Bond and Tokugawa, and between Jinx and Frost. In the end, the daring do of Bond and his pirate allies helps to scuttle the invasion plans, and Tokugawa escapes, only to commit seppuku, ritual suicide. Frost is impaled by her own katana. So that's the story concept. That's the treatment that went into production. So for the project, Wallace assigned Michael Curtiz, the successful WB journeyman director, to direct. Errol Flynn, now a star.
Can I just say, Josh, before you go any further, sorry to interrupt you, buddy, but no, can worries. I just say that I think it's neat how you've got, like, you've kind of got a Miss Tarot character in here, do you know, like with Jinx being a prostitute who's kind of shielding who's disguised as working for, I like that. I think that's quite cool. And it's also believable, like, that she has these Tong affiliations, or she would have an in, you know?
Man, when you said Jinx, I immediately went to, like, the G.I. Joe Jinx, too, which is ironic because I think she was a ninja.
I should state that... that she's an American agent, and I should say that she's a white woman. I should clarify that too.
Okay.
Yeah, because 1930s. Lead and female romantic lead in the 1930s. That's all I have to say. So for this project, Wallace assigned Michael Curtiz, the successful Warner Brothers journeyman director, to direct the film. Errol Flynn, now a star thanks to Captain Blood, which was also directed by Curtiz, is cast as James Bond, the dashing British agent. Bette Davis, having just returned to Warner's following a stint at RKO, was cast as Jinx and underwent some fencing instruction for the part. The same with Olivia de Havilland, the Curtiz-Flynn heroine, was cast against type as the femme fatale Miranda Frost. British actor Leslie Howard... British actor Leslie Howard, really the only British actor with Warner Brothers at the time, Leslie Howard. He was cast as Agent Q, an ally of Bond in Hong Kong, representing the head of intelligence M, who's played by Warren William, who was a American actor, but who played a lot of stern, like handsome, tall, but like paternal figures in a lot of Warner Brothers films and a lot of comedies too.
Yeah,
but
I'm just looking at him here now. Yeah, he's a good fit. Yeah.
Yeah, he actually played Sam Spade in Satan Met a Lady, which was like the second adaptation of The Maltese Falcon that Warner Brothers did that ended up being a comedy. Eric G. Robinson, a Warner Brothers regular, was cast as Fu, who is basically the chief Tong pirate, complete with epicanthic folds makeup. They got the makeup artist from Universal, who did Frankenstein, to take care of to make Edward G. Robinson into a Chinese man, even though it probably cost less money just to hire a Chinese man for the role. But anyway, Zhao is a fun guest cast by Sidney Toler. He played the Chinese detective character Charlie Chan in several movies in the 1930s. So again, we have another Chinese character played by an American actor.
Okay,
he was available at the time, so Wallace nabbed him for the role. The only Chinese actor in the entire film is Anne-Marie Wong, who plays the madam of the Hong Kong brothel.
Right. Okay.
So at first, Jack Warner thought Wallace had lost his mind. He was concerned mostly with the anti-Japanese message for the political reasons, but Wallace managed to get Busby Berkeley interested in it. During his vision quest thing that he had, whatever it was, Wallace saw that the pre-credit sequence for the future source material for his production included a musical segment. Busby found Wallace's explanation both exciting and terrifying, but ponied up at the chance to visualize a man being tortured on a soundstage musical platform. Since Berkeley was hot shit at the moment, Warner agreed. So Die Another Day went into production. The script included a lot of sexual innuendo given its source material, so the Breen office was triggered immediately. Joe Breen came down like a hammer on the screenplay, ensuring that Jinx the Spy, pretending to be a prostitute, made only contact with James Bond as a serving girl in the brothel. Breen wanted to ensure that all the occupants of the brothel, excluding Bond and Jinx, were portrayed as miserable in their decadent state. The screenplay, written by a young maverick named John Huston, through the notes that Wallace gave him, had to be amended with these changes, including making the pirates rebels and not criminals in the end. Breen was not happy with the death of Miranda Frost, impaled by her own sword, and wanted to fight between the two women to be cut down immensely, as he found it bordering on sapphic. This angered stars Davis and de Havilland, who had worked hard to build the scene, as the film was being rushed into production and the script a veritable fever dream being written day to day. The budget was rising too. Harry Warner was not happy. The big musical number was the final nail in the coffin of Die Another Day. All of the film had been shot aside from this expectant, epic musical number. Berkeley had concocted a great soundstage with platforms of ice and of fire and ice, with dancers moving like a scorpion through Flynn as he ran like a madman through the stage, metaphorical of being tortured. Wallace wanted to get a crooner in there to sing the insipid lyrics, but Flynn insisted, to Warner's horror. The ice platform eventually broke, and a stuntman and dancer caught on fire, thankfully only mild burns. The accident and delay cost the Warners millions. Die Another Day was living up to its name, said Jack Warner. Suddenly, Hal Wallace woke up in the dingy Wiltshire Boulevard basement. He got up from his cot, walked out, and drove to his private bungalow on the Burbank lot, vowing to never do mescaline again. And that's the story of how Die Another Day was made and never made. Only in the troubled mind, frazzled mind of Hal Wallace on one bad bender. But
I like it. I like it. I love the idea of there being a musical number on a pirate ship.
Yeah.
The end of it all.
But you like how I kind of turned the scorpions and the ice and the fire and stuff into a musical with like, and it just seemed like, you know, those old musicals. Right? With like the chorus lines moving in a weirdly automaton shapes and stuff like that. Like I thought like a scorpion chasing Errol Flynn through like an ice palace or whatever. I thought that would be like perfect, but, and it was a way to bring the ice palace into it because without it being logical.
It's a way to break the ice.
Yeah, exactly. How to break the ice. So yeah, but outside of the fun I had there, you know, coming up with that based on, you know, Hollywood history and, you know, trying to be a period accurate in the best way possible, even to the point of trying to create a reason why an old movie, why a modern movie would be made at a time like that. Maybe I went overboard, but I will state that the actors, directors, crew, you know, and producers, I think that is definitely the unit that would have made Die Another Day at that time, like 100%.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. who was it again that you got to do the music? I don't believe you. I heard you say that.
Oh, the music is Adolf Deutsch. Sorry about that.
Deutsch.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, not Deutsch. Deutsch. Oh, my goodness. No, I don't. Well, no, sorry. Korngold wasn't available, so they got Adolf Deutsch.
Right. Korngold wasn't available, so you got Deutsch. Nice work. Nice one.
Yeah, he was caught between other Errol Flynn products. Caught between other Errol...
That's right, yeah.
Errol Flynn projects. Yeah.
What if indeed Die Another Day from 1938, did you say?
This would have been released in 1937 by the end of the production.
1937.
If it did exist. But just for those who don't know, like, Hal Wallace was like the right-hand man of Zanuck. And then when Zanuck left Warner Brothers, Hal Wallace produced a ton of great films from like the mid-30s to like the 50s onwards. Like he was a big producer. He went into independent stuff too. Like, I think he was the producer of Beckett, I believe. And I think The Lion in Winter too, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Drum roll.
Oh, I know why I know his name, because he did Elvis films. That's why I know his name. He did King Creole, G.I. Blues, Loving You. He did a lot of Elvis. Blue Hawaii was his. Girls, Girls, Girls. That's why I know his name.
Arthur, are you talking about Arthur Rankin Jr.?
Is that, maybe. Sorry, I don't know who I'm talking about. Hal Wallace. No, that's who I'm thinking of.
Hal Wallace.
It's just not the guy. Okay. Yeah. He's done tons of stuff for sure. High Sierra, Josh mentioned.
Yeah. But yeah, he was the Warner Brothers like main dude, right? Like up until like the mid-40s when Jerry Wald took his place, kind of, because eventually he got Hal Wallace got tired of Jack Warner as well.
He did Mary Queen of Scots as well.
He did, yeah. Because he did a lot of those those indie, quasi indie like historical films you see like in the late 60s. He was behind them, and he also produced True Grit, which the 1969 original with John Wayne.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Nice one. Okay, great. Well, let's skip ahead then a few years, and we've got Double O Chapman. Double O Chapman is going to take us through a 1940s adaptation of GoldenEye.
Yeah.
I'm writing you from somewhere in France, hoping this finds you well. Sergeant says I'm doing fine, a soldier and a half. Here's a song that we'll all sing, it'll make you laugh. We're going to hang out the washing on the Siegfried line. Have you any dirty washing, Mother dear?
So one thing I realized, I didn't come up with a producer. I have the director, editor, cinematographer, sound coordinator, but I have a production designer, but I just realized I don't actually have a producer. So Josh, I'm gonna ask you, what kind of producer do you think would produce a GoldenEye?
Well, it depends. What studio do you want for it?
Well,
do you want MGM?
That's a great question. MGM? Well, actually, I'm using Denham Studios, which did A Matter of Life and Death, which also was called Straight to Heaven, which has
Powell and Pressburger, David man. Just get them to produce it.
Yeah, just get Pressburger.
Okay.
Yeah. Or you could even say, like, Orson Welles came on to produce, like, Carol Reed. He could have came on. He was into that stuff. Heck, you can get Hitchcock to produce if you... I don't know if he was doing producing at the time. He directed his own stuff, but I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, Pressburger's Hitchcock... Good. Actually, yeah, he might produce it, because considering... Well, you'll see. But yeah.
Pressburger's a good choice.
And though. I'm using Pinewood Studios and Denham Studios, but okay.
Yeah, Pressburger's a good
choice. Okay, and then Pressburger it is. Mm-hmm. My adaptation is GoldenEye. So I chose GoldenEye, and I chose it in the year of 1948. One of the main reasons, you can laugh if you will, is obviously they're going to be fighting Russian/Soviet people. They're the aggressors, whatever. And I you can't, now everyone knows the AK-47. And if I had it before that, they couldn't use them. And I'm like, I still want the AK-47. So I made a 48 because the AK-47 was now in production and it wasn't old. It was brand new.
Okay, cool.
First, I'm actually gonna just sort of describe, the crew and the cast. So I decided a good director for this. I chose Billy Wilder, who directed Double Indemnity and Sunset Boulevard. I thought it might be good because he did those kind of noir films, and I thought it would be really neat to have him do this style of film. Okay. For the editor, I chose Derek Twist, who did 39 Steps. Again, a nice sort of
British work there, film. Yeah.
Yep. And for cinematography, I chose Robert Krasker from Third Man because for one of our non-Bonds, when we watched The Third Man, that movie and its cinematography blew my mind. And I was like, this, I would love to see. I was just thinking like, that would be great. I think that would work pretty well. And I was thinking, there's got to be a pretty badass stunt coordinator. And I don't know stunt people from that time. And I was thinking, because obviously James Bond movies and stunts, but obviously I was like, who could I have? So I found this guy named Paul Baxley.
Okay.
And he was a stunt coordinator. He would have been 25 at the time. He did a lot of stuff. Like he was a Marine sniper in World War II. He had 2 Purple Hearts, Bronze Star, letter of commendation from the president. And in the late 40s, he was doing stunts in movies such as Deep Valley, Pirates of the Monterey, The Lady from Shanghai, The Black Arrow, and Comanche Territory. Nice. So some I good thought, films in there. He could probably do some pretty good stunts. And, he would be, if you had him in charge of the stunts, then I think he'd do okay. So for production designer, I chose Alfred Young, also from A Matter of Life and Death, which I had mentioned previously, was again another film that we had done in a non-Bond. That was recommended by you, Scott. That movie, I blew my mind.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I really liked it. And the writer, surprise, Ian Fleming. Why not?
Why not, indeed.
This is the one that I thought everyone's going to have a chuckle about, is the special technical advisor, who obviously would have been recommended by Fleming. Later on, it might be a bit of a faux pas and a bit of controversy, but it would be Kim Philby.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I like that.
Just a little bit.
Slightly. The score is by Miklos Rosa.
Great choice there. I think that
would be pretty cool. And the song is going to be performed by Peggy Lee.
Okay.
Oh, very good. Okay, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, a very young Peggy Lee at the time. So now I'm going to go over the cast. Just going to quickly. So Bond, again, there's a bit of a – you'll notice a pattern here with that film, A Matter of Life and Death, or Stairway to Heaven, depending, where you watched it. 77 years ago. David Niven is who I chose for Bond. There's a few reasons. Just because, one, I think he's excellent. Two, he has roots and connections to
crime.
Intelligence. He was crime. Oh, yeah. That too.
Fleming as well.
Yeah.
Fleming. He was. He was technically. He had military service, commando, stuff like that. For Moneypenny, Lois Maxwell. I went with Lois Maxwell, and she was a very, very young and up and coming actress at the time. She would have only been 21 years old in 1948.
Yeah,
so a young Moneypenny. Yep, exactly. I chose Sydney Greenstreet as M. And we obviously he's known for many, many films, obviously including
playing a good guy. Talking.
Yeah, he's playing a good guy this time, right?
Yeah,
exactly. Xenia is played by none other than Hedy Lamarr.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Natalia is Alita Valli from Third Man. I thought that would work pretty well. Mm-hmm. Boris, I chose Peter Lorre.
yeah, he's a good one.
I'm invincible. I could just picture Peter Lorre saying, but it would be like, I'm invincible. Right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Right? And then Jack Wade, I chose a young, fairly young Burt Lancaster.
Value. That's an interesting choice. That's take me through your thinking there with Lancaster. Go on, take me through your thinking.
Well, like, wait, you know, how old was
he? Was in his 30s. Oh, I think he was
He'd be okay.
Yeah. He would be, yeah. He wasn't that young. And he was already doing noirs at the time of your casting. He was like in a bunch of noirs. That's like a year before what's it called? Crisscross, I think. Crisscross was 49, I believe.
Yeah, so he would have been, 35, I think, at this point?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because he was born in 1913, right? So.
Yep.
He's a big guy. And I just feel he could. I was trying to think of like an American actor that could play an American CIA agent, which was brand new at the time. And I just thought it would be interesting. And I was trying to go through, you know, who would be easy on the eyes, you know, that kind of stuff too, like
sure.
kind of American beefcake. And I thought, well, you mm-hmm, know, mm-hmm. And also when I, because obviously this is kind of like the Guns N' Roses Chinese Democracy episode where this has been sort of on the books for so long. I think I had chosen, right? That's a reference. If people don't know what Chinese Democracy is, I'm not talking about actual Chinese Democracy. I'm talking about a Guns N' Roses album, which had been in the talks for many, many years. Anyways, I'm just talking about the length of time it's taken us to do this episode. That was my point.
We can feel blessed, we had just recently watched we were there when it came out. So.
Oh, yeah. And then, boy, was that a letdown. Burt Lancaster was not. But I think I chose Burt Lancaster because I was still sort of on a contact high from watching The Train. Also, again, Scott, great choice. Or was that you or was that Josh?
No, that was me too. I'm striking.
That was your choice. Yeah.
You're welcome. And so Trevelyan, I thought, okay, I'm trying to think of, you know, you'll notice here that a lot of these people are very, it's a very close-knit group, right? Mm-hmm. So I was like, Christopher Lee.
Yeah.
Okay. Nice one.
Okay. So I got confused. Sorry. Trevelyan. Okay. So Lancaster is playing Jack Wade then.
Jack Wade. Correct.
Yeah, okay. Sorry. Cool.
If I said Trevelyan before, I think I made it and I apologize because I think I was getting ahead of myself. Sorry. To reiterate,
no
Jack
worries.
Wade is Burt Lancaster. Yeah.
I am aware of the
dangers. Trevelyan is Christopher Lee. Valentin is Peter Ustinov. I think that's
that's a great pick.
I think that one works pretty well. Uh-huh. I think that works pretty well. Also, good friends with David Niven, if I'm not mistaken. Q is Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, why not?
Why not?
What would his fee have been? Just out of curiosity.
Probably
1948. I'm sure you could afford them, but there's a lot of big money in this film, man.
Yeah, there. I know.
He can pay for the budget loss. He can pay for the profit loss from Under Capricorn.
There you go. Bill Tanner. I chose Bernard Lee. I thought that would be ironic and
okay. Yeah,
I thought that was a good choice. And Irina. We all like Irina, you know, who a mini driver, that very small, annoying role of the
girlfriend
with the cowboy hat doing karaoke. Now, it's not really going to be karaoke. It's probably going to be burlesque, but I chose a very, very young and up-and-coming starlet by the name of Marilyn Monroe.
Hey.
Okay. Hey. Yep. And so for Siberia, for the location, I chose Whistler, BC.
Just because.
Just because, yeah. And so for some of the cars and gadgets, so, okay, the car, I tried to find a car that, you know, obviously we want to have like there's always like a new car and a fancy car. And you know, I'm like, well, what do we have back then? And so I actually found a Jaguar XK120 and from 1948. And that thing is, I don't know if you guys can look it up.
I'm looking it up right now, buddy. I know our listeners can't see
it. It's a nice red one.
Jaguar XK.
Oh, boy, it's nice.
XK120, 1948. Oh, yeah, look at that.
So there's one. Yeah, yeah.
Look, it kind of has a smaller, a more squat Silver Phantom sort of look to it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's a bit like a Roadster version of a Silver Phantom.
Yeah, it's like a Roadster. Yeah, I was going to say, you could totally see a James Bond drive the shit
out. Oh, dude, absolutely. That's a fantastic pick, man. That's great. And it would look great.
And that's why, because I'll be honest, I was going like, okay, 47, 48. Like, I needed to be like, you know, like right on the dot, because you're going to have the money. And I was like, woo, that's right there. And it's Jaguar, so it's British too, right? So I was like, yeah.
Awesome.
Okay, so we know that there was like in GoldenEye, there was that prototype helicopter, right? And so, okay, like obviously in the 90s, helicopters, that's a very, very common thing right from the, you know, in the 50s. But then I was like, okay, well, I still want to see if I can get a helicopter. But obviously in the 40s, helicopters were, you know, just in their infancy. And there was, but I did find the original like prototype of a Sikorsky. And it actually, ironically enough, had its first flight in 1947. It was a Sikorsky YR-5A helicopter. Cool. And so, yeah. And so, luckily enough, like I was able to, I chose that as sort of the prototype helicopter that they use in the film. And I thought, the other thing, I'm a big fan of, you know, Dick Tracy and the Shadow and stuff. And so I was like, oh, I'm going to use the gadgets, a radio watch, because, hey.
Why not? Yeah,
and why not? Because I mean, I really,
it's conceivable for the time as well. Like,
that's what I mean. It is conceivable.
I can see war technology being microed to that level in 5 years.
And so, for one of the other prototypes, because there's also like a plane, and I was going to use the Yak-30, which the Yak-30 kind of looks, it's one of those sort of like early makes where I don't know if you guys know, like,
I do. Planes, I know like all the F-86, too well.
The F-86, like. Oh, yeah, the F-86 Sabre, it kind of has the same kind of like, you know, I honestly think those style of jets,
kind of a stump nose
style like that, I hate that look. I know that they're pretty good for the time, but they just look ugly to me.
I hear you, man. I know what you're on about, though. Yeah.
So one thing I was also going to mention is obviously GoldenEye. A lot of people know that Fleming named it his estate in Jamaica on the Orca. Am I saying that right? Orca Bessa Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And he bought. And ironically enough, he actually bought it in '46, and he built his home there. So I'm like, good, because I was like, it's going to be harder for me to try and keep the title GoldenEye if it's not even.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
But it works. Luckily, it works for the time.
Yeah. The funny thing is obviously, realistically, he actually started to write the Bonds in the 50s. But whatever, it is what it is.
Doesn't matter.
How I tried to make it work was, you know, at the beginning of GoldenEye, where it says 1986, right? So technically, it's when we're watching the film, you know. Current time in 95 when it came out, they're saying it's in 86, so it's still like the Cold War, it's still, you know, Soviet Union stuff. So then I'm like, how do I do this? So I made it 1946. So it's basically the beginnings of the Cold War, right? And and so MI6 is still MI6. And Bond and Trevelyan, it's the same thing. Well, basically, they're infiltrating like a Soviet chemicals facility. And, you know, Trevelyan gets caught as soon as he's killed. The difference is, you know, when they go, 9 years later, then it shows, you know, Bond driving his the Aston Martin.
The DB5,
I only made it 2 years later. okay. which would make it okay. current time of 48, okay. basically. Yeah.
So a yeah. 2-year gap between like yeah. the opening incident and versus like the start of the story, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. So the difference there was that instead of the bungee jump, it was the prototype helicopter picking him up. That's what I chose cool. there because
okay,
like, as good as I had mentioned, as good as I mentioned that Paul Baxter guy, I
don't think he's going to be doing that. No production time.
But if there's anyone that could do it, I think it would be him. Yeah. And the other thing was, I was thinking because of sort of the all the you know computers and hacking and stuff in the film, that was going to be tough. So I kind of made it like cryptology, like, and I was actually having a hard time just trying to find like what department had cryptology in the KGB at the time. But I was going to say like basically like Boris was. I think it was called Section 10, and they were kind of like cryptology and stuff like that for the Russians. And the other thing, again, because they didn't have satellites, is I was going to make it just basically an EMP instead of a satellite because they didn't have satellites yet. But that was sort of like me trying to retrofit all of this.
Good enough, yeah.
It
works.
Yeah, that was
– yeah.
It works. And I was trying to think of, like, would I have an opening credit? And I'm like, I guess they could do an opening, but I would prefer to probably just do a gun barrel, you know, something like that.
What about the song? How's Peggy Lee going to be brought into the stage then? What's her shining moment? End credits?
Yeah, I think it would be end credits. That's okay. The only thing I was really thinking. I'm going to be honest with you. I kind of... I thought of this now. But what if she was really fed up with the arena, pushed her off the stage, and just
all right? I like that. We had a musical 5-minute interlude
yeah,
right there.
Yeah, exactly.
Very diegetic.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking. And then and when she
that would be the first diegetic Bond song,
right?
Yeah, certainly it predates the octopusy snake charm moment.
And you know what happens, though, is Irina is singing, performing, and then there's a gust of wind, and it blows up her skirt, and then she freezes, and then Peggy Lee's like, the show must go on. Right, and she just throws her off the stage, and then I'm just kidding, but yeah.
Nice one. I like that. I like that. So just before we leave yours, what do you think is going to resonate most with audiences in 1948 about your GoldenEye?
I think like how the hell to get all that cast, where all the money come from.
Yeah. The production.
And to what the hell is a helicopter?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Bond's a bit of a trendsetter, you know, it's technology. James Bond, right. It was Roger Moore who first rode on a jet ski. And it was Roger Moore who didn't first do it. His film first kind of promoted the idea of a snowboard, right? So, yeah, I think right. it's, yeah. I think there's true. Room for it. There's room for it. Yeah,
it's true. Very good. Dear.
Nice work.
It is tricky. And
It is tricky.
Yeah.
But it's fun at the same time.
Yeah, it's a good experiment. It's a good experiment. And that brings us to the 1950s and my turn for Tomorrow Never Dies.
Over to you, yeah.
All right.
Just a gigolo, and everywhere I go, people know the part I'm playing. Paid for every dance, selling his romance. Oh, at the scene. There will come a day, and youth will pass away. What will they say about me?
Okay, so guys, a little bit of context first. for my adaptation. Right, so following Mussolini's death and the fall of fascism in Italy, Italy became a republic, and it had a few different leaders until the eight solid years after or under Alcide De Gasperi. Now, he was prime minister from 45 to 53, and in that time, Italy succeeded in rebuilding relations with allied nations, okay? It signed a new peace treaty in 1947. It joined NATO the year following, or was it 1949 maybe? The Marshall Plan, enacted in 1948, saw America provide over $13 billion, which is about $173 billion today, to recovery programs in Western Europe. Italy was a beneficiary of those monies. The Marshall Plan helped to rebuild war-torn areas, remove trade barriers, modernize industry, and propagandize too, of course, preventing the spread of communism. So that type of context, I just needed to drop because action in my adaptation of Tomorrow Never Dies takes place in Italy, or part of it anyway. So cool. My film is not set in China like the 1997 Tomorrow Never Dies, and I don't go to the Orient like Josh did in his film either. Instead, set in Italy of the early to mid 1950s, okay? Now, The American context is deeply steeped in McCarthyism at the time. Italy is still rebuilding a decade after conflict, but it's under a more stable government, as I just outlined. But during the early and eager years of the Marshall Plan, Italy was only too keen for American interests to come in and to set up shop. There's obviously historical precedent for this as well. So the context fits, I think. Under the cover of this open doors environment and the willingness to help, my villain walks in and sets up shop, okay? So Elliot Carver, an American entrepreneur, a media owner who was bequeathed a small local radio station and a newspaper in the Midwest prior to World War II. Now, by means both legal and illegal, Carver's brand made an intrepid name for itself during the war by pioneering methods of conflict zone reporting and spreading American media during the Reconstruction of Europe. So he makes his fortune throughout the nail-biting years of wartime radio by going where other broadcasters won't, embodying,
like a Walter
and spreading, embodying and spreading democracy as he grew. At the end of the war, Carver established his headquarters overseas to Italy, where American money and businesses, like I said, was really welcome. There, bulked up by grants from the Marshall Plan, his mission was to broadcast American news to the world and return news of American interests back home. Okay, that started to take off. As new audiences and new demands grew, so did the expansion, so did the profits. And in the 10 years following the war, Carver's Democracy for All mission helped American ideals spread in Western Europe, and he made a name for himself through philanthropy and charitable causes. Behind the scenes, however, Carver had been filtering funds to deal with less liberty-loving causes. So as our treatment of Tomorrow Never Dies begins, MI6 is suspicious of Elliot Carver's empire. Lately, intelligence has suggested that Carver has been meeting with and supplying weapons to communist sympathizers. So as in the original film, this picture starts with a weapons bazaar as well, which Bond infiltrates without knowing one of Carver's men is there. This would be the Gupta figure that we get. So right. In the 1997 film, the Chinese and the British governments are both sending agents to investigate Carter, which lead to a team up. Here, the Italians send their own agent, a honey trap type of figure, months, maybe a year before Bond shows up. So Bond is brought in to help them with no knowledge of that internal appointment. So Bond works with the Italians without knowing there's a honey trap figure that's actually an Italian agent already set in the midst, okay? And that's kind of how I've worked the context of my adaptation for 1958. Like locations in my picture, we've got London, we've got Zurich. There's going to be a cool scene on the tram lines in Zurich. Italy is a big, big picture focus here. We're going to Naples. We're going to Catania in Sicily and the Aeolian Islands. Okay, the Aeolian Islands. Mm-hmm. So in terms of direction. Trieste? What's that?
No Trieste? No,
I'm afraid not. Cars. Check out the cars, okay? I've got Bond's Ferrari 250 GT Coupe from 1957. Check it out, boys. Mm-hmm. Bond's Ferrari 250 GT, 1957. I want you to look at it.
Okay.
Tell me if you like it as much as Jeff's choices. Ferrari 250 GT.
Oh man, are you? This is ridiculous.
That's a nice one, huh? That's Bond's car.
I'm just comparing.
This is a 58 version, correct?
58 or 57, oh, either one. I had 57 in mind, but it's a nice silver in there. 57. Oh,
you guys are definitely right on the Jaguar. That's a beautiful car. I'm glad I checked that.
Wow.
DG Coupe, 1958, right?
Holy smokes, man! This thing is
57 or 58.
What color?
I like the red one actually.
Yeah.
19.
Well,
nice silver one as well.
There's a one that's kind of almost like a graphite color. It's awesome.
Yeah,
it's sexy. Because it reminds me of the color of the Aston Martin. You know what I mean? The DB.
I think I saw a similar car to this in The Man from U.N.C.L.E., the Guy Ritchie movie, if I'm not mistaken.
I can see where you're coming from. Man, anyway, good choice on that.
Yeah, you guys had great choices with cars.
You're still in horse and wagon mode.
Well, the Model T's.
There was just big sets built for like Hong Kong and for a fortress and stuff. There just wasn't time for a car chase in that story, unfortunately.
Exactly.
They were too busy working on like a ridiculous musical sequence for like the opening credits.
So that's Bond's ride. He's going to rent that once he gets into Italy. The second car I want you guys to look out is the 1956 Maserati A6, because that is what Carver drives, a 1956 Maserati A6.
Oh, yep. Oh my God, yes.
You're liking that one, huh? That's pretty cool as well, I thought.
I think we're looking at pinups or something. That's what it sounds like on the...
we're having... Yeah, so that's...
Is it the Maserati, the G6?
Like an Aston Martin, a little bit.
It's that's nice.
May I say,
all right,
feminine lines almost, just to make things weird, feminine like curves almost on this thing. Like it's interesting, very interesting. Freud can go to places here.
Freudian, yeah. Okay, I'll move on. I'll get on with it.
Yeah,
it's very very nice.
So those are the cars. Now they don't make picture, like that anymore. Tomorrow Never Dies, 1958. My picture is going to be directed by the one and only William Wyler. Heavily decorated director. I know you guys all know that. 3 Oscar wins, Ben-Hur, The Best Years of Our Lives, and Mrs. Miniver. 12 nominations for directing. Now, if you listen to Kirk Douglas or Olivia de Havilland, Josh, one of your own, Audrey Hepburn, Gary Cooper, Greg Peck, Peter O'Toole, Greer Garson, Betty Davis, like the list goes on. He was able to get more out of his actors than anybody that really he ever worked with, and was really highly creative perfectionist. He had experience on location filming Roman Holiday. So I think a production in Sicily a few years after that would have been really easy and welcoming for him. He'd probably be able to use the local crews, the people he knew, you know, his caterers. It would all have sorted out really smoothly. He's also got experience with action, right? With The Big Country and Ben-Hur, and some romance and comedy and drama, really critically high level. But he's also capable of just fun movies too. And I think because he was a highly decorated soldier, he rose to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel in the U.S. Army Signal Corps. I think that, and he did National Guard as well, years from 21 to 22, and enlisted in the war after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. I think he was up for it. He was given a Purple Heart, for Christ's sake. Like, I think he'd be able to work well with a new James Bond, you know?
Yeah, he was directing up until World War II. Like, he was directing films, and he enlisted after Pearl Harbor, like, dropped his career. I mean, a lot of actors and directors did, and some of them had to go to war, but Wyler went right for it. Like, yeah, he's a pretty awesome guy. I think he was actually made deaf from the war, if I'm not mistaken. He was directing. He was almost made deaf in one ear, I think it was. And he was directing Best Years of Our Lives, and he was dealing with that. And that's why, like, the cinematographer Greg Tolan was a lot of help to him while he made the movie. Just some trivia there for you.
Cool little story there, yeah. Bit of trivia. Well, my picture is going to be produced by Samuel Goldwyn. I'm going MGM for this one. And
there you go.
The editor... Don't know if you guys are familiar with this guy, but he does good work in and around this time. Hugh Fowler, 7-Year Itch, Patton, which was a few years after this, Planet of the Apes. And he also did In Like Flint, which is kind of the same milieu, you know? So I'm going there with that.
Our Man Flint?
Hmm?
Our Man Flint, you mean?
This was In Like Flint. Our Man Flint, same series, though, yeah.
Okay. Because I was thinking, like, isn't that an Errol
Flynn? Like Flynn?
Yeah. I was wondering, like, what came before the chicken or the egg there in terms of that idiom? But okay, cool.
Yeah, In Like Flint is James Coburn, 1967, wasn't it? I think maybe it's 65, but
that was like an attempt at an American James Bond, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's an American spy comedy sort of thing. It's a sequel to that. To Our Man Flint, right?
Okay, but cool, awesome.
Our Man Flint wasn't edited by Hugh Fowler, so I got to go with this one.
I understand completely.
Right, so who else we got here? Music, right. Listen, guys, I gotta go with Dmitri Tiomkin.
I knew it.
Composer, did some banging films in this era. I'm going with him. And Patsy Cline is going to sing the title song.
Oh,
cool.
Cool.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought that would be good for Patsy. Yeah. Oh, good one, Josh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you might say it drives you crazy. Huh?
Yes. The Music of Pain.
The Music of Pain. The film was shot by Robert Burks, who was Hitchcock's favorite DP. So I just figured get a big name in there. Production design. Nice. Production design. Look, Sid Kane is there. I know he did later Bonds as well. Later in his career, he did Bonds. But Our Man in Havana, the original, Lolita, he did that one as well for Kubrick. So he's got a nice eye. Robert Boyle's the other one I was thinking about. The original Thomas Crown Affair, In Cold Blood, Cape Fear.
Oh,
I think you put these two guys together on a little team, you know, they'd be a good production set. Good partnership.
Right.
So we got Goldwyn producing Wyler's film, or rather Wyler directing Goldwyn's film. Music by Tiomkin, Patsy Cline. Cinematography by Burks. Edited by Hugh Fowler with Sid Kane and Robert Boyle teaming up on production. So it's very, very male heavy, very male driven. I'm aware of that. I'm aware of that. Here we go. Cast now. Okay. It's what you've all been waiting for. My James Bond is going to be played by the 5'10" Richard Burton. Very young Bond, but he's going to be the one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I was thinking about using him myself.
He'd have been young then, though, wouldn't he? A little
then I was like, wait a second. And then I looked it up and I'm like, okay, yeah, it's a bit.
He was kind of hanging around Hollywood at the time, too, not just like in England, like on the British stage, but before he died, he was kind of like not a member of the Rat Pack, but he hung out with that crowd, but he was very close to like the Bogarts, actually. And I guess after he died, Bogart died, Burton then went on to, he made his connections, which allowed him to get bigger roles in the industry after that, right? But having Bogart for a drinking bud is not a bad thing to have for a young British actor, you know what I mean? So,
no, not at all, not at all. I think Josh, or Jeff, I think he'd have been just in his early 20s when your film was coming out.
He was born in 23, so he would have been 25.
I was going to think of a big movie he would have been in. Oh, 56 or so? That would have been Alexander the Great, because he did that, like, I think in 55, 56, I think it was, around that time.
Okay, all right.
It was when was The Robe? And The Robe was around that time, too. And that was Fox, I believe. Because it was a big CinemaScope film. So he was just starting his career. So, yeah, good choice.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on then. So Richard Burton's going to be my Bond. Get a Welsh Bond in there early days. I think that would be cool. My Elliot Carver, this was tough, but I'm going with Anthony Quinn. At 6'1", he's bigger than Burton. I know physically there's a difference there, but I don't care. I don't think that matters. I mean, look at Daniel Craig's 5'10", isn't he? Something around that. And he's played against bigger guys. And, you know, there would be some fighting in here, but it's okay. I think that works well. So the Paris Carver role, right? The villain's girlfriend. That is the Wei Lin role in my film. So Carver's girlfriend turns out to be the SIOS agent, right? who's planted by the Italians as the honey trap. So she's been part of his network for 3 years. And when Bond gets close, the two of them work together. So that's a little bit different in my film. Paris Carver and Wei Lin are not different characters in mine. They are the same character, essentially. Okay. And it's going to be played by Gina Lollobrigida.
Ah, so R.I.P., by the way.
A little bit R.I.P.
Gina, wait. Yeah? Let me see.
Yeah. It's heavy lifting.
No, go.
Heavy lifting for her. I know she needs to play a double agent, essentially, but I've simplified her role by taking away the old flame feature that Terry Hatcher had to carry with her. And instead, give that to a different character. I'll talk about in a moment. So I'm kind of drawing on a bit of like Lupe from License to Kill here, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. How Bond infiltrates and then uses her help with the additional story strength of her being an agent, you know, that comes in handy later. That's what Gina Lollobrigida is going to be. That's what she's going to do. So that's Paris Carver. I haven't really thought of a name for her yet, but I'm keeping James Bond, Elliot Carver. I just don't think Paris Carver works for an Italian, you know, who... So I'll come up with a different name for her when the studios need me to.
Simonetta Carver.
Sure, we'll go with that one. Marianne Russell. Now, I've brought in this character of the MI6 attaché, okay? I really wanted to bring this character in because there's Fleming precedent for her. She's in A View to a Kill, the short story. And my film does ultimately involve an old flame. As with Tomorrow Never Dies in 97, this old flame does get killed for working with Bond. So I'm going back to Fleming a little bit here. I'm using the Marianne Russell character, who, like I said, he worked with in the short story, but I'm putting her in Italy. So Bond's old flame and is also his first contact when he reaches Italy. She's the one who he wines and dines, but she's then killed by Carver's heavy when the connection is revealed. And Marianne Russell is going to be played by Audrey Hepburn.
Well, William Wyler is like a director that she worked with a lot, so that fits perfectly.
Yeah, that's going to fit. I think that'll be nice. And then we've got our kind of a supporting cast, if you will. My M, this was the first person I cast as M, Laurence Olivier, 1958, I think would make a great M.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm going to go with him. I like it. Q, James Mason is my Q.
Yes.
I need to get him in there.
James Mason is?
Oh, yeah.
You need your James Mason in there.
I got to, man. If I had a chance to make a movie in the 50s, I don't care what it is, James Mason is going in it. He's just...
Yeah, it's fair. I think
he's my man from that time. Right, tell me what you think of this guy's Jack Wade. My Jack Wade, Tomorrow Never Dies, is going to be played by Gene Kelly. What do you think?
Oh,
interesting.
Jack Wade by Gene Kelly, eh? Mm-hmm. Interesting.
A roll against type. But does he have like a one-off dance number?
Well, I don't know. He might be able to work a dance in there, but I hadn't thought of him quite that on the nose. But yeah, maybe.
Maybe make,
might also give Gene Kelly something a little different to do.
Maybe make a one of the henchmen like Fred Astaire and then have a Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire dance off or something like that.
Good. The Gupta role. Gupta is going to be played by Robert Mitchum, who's just fantastic. Ooh. He's a great actor. And
Mitchum's cool. I love think Robert Mitchum.
He would work, you know, that kind of
good choice.
Yeah. Stamper. You want to take a guess at who I'm going for? He's 6'5", my Stamper.
6'5". Oh man, there's not that many tall people.
6'5", Stamper. Let me think.
Solid as a rock.
Oh, Rock Hudson.
There you go, Rock Hudson.
There you go.
Really?
Stamper.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. My Money Penny is Deborah Kerr. And
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great actor. Great Scottish actor, actually. And finally, here we go. This is my most inspired piece of casting, I think. It is, of course, Dr. Kaufman, played by Vincent Price. Somewhere between his performance in Laura and House on Haunted Hill. So I don't want total crazy Vincent Price. I want kind of creepy Vincent Price, but also he has to be a bit believable, you know?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's an American production of anti-communist propaganda, but using a hyperbolic capitalist figure and his corruption to make audiences doubt everything. That's my film. That's my Tomorrow Never Dies. 1950.
And
buy your tickets now.
Yeah, and did the House of Un-American come for William Wyler after this movie, I wonder?
I'm not at liberty to disclose that information.
Yeah, but that said, you know what also makes your villain even more hateable, besides being played by like a badass like Anthony Quinn, is the fact that he kills Audrey Hepburn. He literally fulfills the trope of kicking the puppy. Like, you know what I mean? So
yeah,
automatically, yeah, it makes yeah, it, it yeah. it'll make audiences hate him right away.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he
I love it.
Yeah, that's that. There you go. That's three different looks at Bond in the Hollywood era. Or sorry, the golden age of Hollywood, starting in the 1930s with Josh's pirate musical. I don't know if it's fair
whatever
to call it
that,
but
that's Dream.
I like to call it Asian Fusion.
Asian Fusion.
It's something.
Sounds like a booster juice flavor.
I just like giving Jack Warner the non-historical quote of Die Another Day is living up to its name because of the budget bleeding every day because of it.
I got to say, Scott, I really like how you chose 1950s Italy and, you know, the communism that's going on. There was communism going on there. And I like how you chose that instead of using the China. I thought that.
Yeah, I just thought it was something different. Plus, it gets me in Italy, and I love Italy.
It makes sense. Yeah,
I think it'd be fun to film there.
No, 100% that makes sense.
And the 50s Italy, man, like just like Rossellini, you know, just like the visual aesthetic of it and whatnot, and mm-hmm. Wyler mm-hmm. going at that with his own visual style and stuff. And yeah,
if you're going at that, like, you know, for 50, yeah, like we're saying, like Joseph was just saying, is 1950s Italy cinema in general. That's a really good choice. I think good job on that, man. That's
cool. Yeah, cool. Well, thanks, now, guys. I'm glad you enjoyed that.
Thing. Black and white or Technicolor?
There you go.
I thought about that. It's definitely Technicolor. I'm not definitely a color film guy at all, but for this, have to be. I think it would have to be because I want to communicate what he didn't do with Roman Holiday, which is produce the color of the film. I want him to bring that out. Do you know what I mean? I want that. I want the cars to shine. You know what I mean? I need the colors of the stone and the sea. Yeah. Because so much of it takes place in Italy and off the coast of Italy on the Aeolian Islands. Places I've been, by the way. So, you know, I feel like I know the party.
Like you've already done all the scouting.
I've done it all, yeah.
When Wyler made Roman Holiday, they originally wanted color, but it was too expensive at the time. They basically have to go make a set, essentially, like film a lot of it on sets. And that felt that it would lose the whole content of the story would be lost. So that's why Wyler decided to go black and white and film on location, right? And it works fantastic
in that case,
the movie. Yeah.
I guess this is a bit of redemption for him then. He gets to go do his color film in Italy a year or two after.
He has the technology has advanced by that point, and he has a bit of a budget behind him. So there you go.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
That's a good point. Well, you know what, guy? I was thinking if I was going to do mine in color, but then I thought, I don't know, it's 48, so there's almost nothing. However, the only thing, though, is remember I was talking about the film, the A Matter of Life and Death. That was there was actually color in that film. In
sure, parts,
right?
Yeah, well, The Wizard of Oz,
that's
right?
I'm like, so I'm like,
musicals were in color in the late 40s, but I don't know, but. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's what I'm thinking. I think I might still stick with black and white, but maybe I could have chosen the color for the title sequence. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Or the song.
When Marilyn's kicked off the stage,
exactly,
you could cut to color.
I think everyone would want to see that in color. Yeah,
it's kind of a Wizard of Oz moment, right? Like when Dorothy leaves the house and enters Oz, right? Munchkin Land, it goes to color. So from Cynthia
I can also picture.
Yeah.
I can also picture Arena say to Peggy Lee when she kicks her off the stage, "I'll get you, my pretty."
Right. Okay. Yeah. So good fun there for our final What If of Bond by Numbers. And that just sets up our final episode, guys, episode 100, where we're going to say goodbye to all of this craziness, these shenanigans, this good fun, and the 5 years we spent together on the show. So thanks everybody for listening and checking out this episode of Bond by Numbers. We will return for our final episode in a couple of weeks' time. It'll be a good one. You won't want to miss it. You can find us on the socials at BBN_pod and email us bondbynumbers3@gmail.com if there's anything specific you want to ask or share. We appreciate all the engagements and the nice words over the years, over the episodes. And we're going to put together a really great finale for you and for ourselves, most importantly, for ourselves.
Yeah.
To recognize and celebrate these fun seasons of James Bondom.
Exactly. And for those who still want to celebrate Bond, Scott and I are doing the John Gardner James Bond novel reviews on Lighting the Pipes. So please check those out.
Yeah, we will continue the Bond reading, absolutely.
Yeah.
Right, boys, thanks for the fun. And everybody, thank you for listening. We'll see you back here soon on Bond by Numbers.
Toodles.
Cheerio.